Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for August 31st, 2006. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the world of economics and politics. I've got two segments up for tonight. First, we'll speak with Betsy Reed, editor of a collection of essays from The Nation magazine called Unnatural Disaster about Hurricane Katrina. And we also should be joined, hope he gets here, by Gary Young, who is a writer for the correspondent for The Guardian newspaper and also a frequent contributor to The Nation, and has a couple pieces in this collection. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with John Mueller, who is a political scientist at Ohio State, who has a provocative piece in the July-August issue of Foreign Affairs, which is the hyper-establishment journal of the Council on Foreign Relations. Is there still a terrorist threat? And the Foreign Affairs summary: despite all the ominous warnings of wily terrorists and imminent attacks, there has been neither a successful strike nor a close call in the U.S. since 9/11. The reasonable but rarely heard explanation is that there are no terrorists within the United States and few have the means or inclination to strike from abroad. And as he says in the piece, you more have a greater risk of drowning in the bathtub than you do of getting killed by a terrorist. But there is no Department of Bathtub Security in Washington, is there? But before we get to all this, just a couple of observations on the news. And at the bottom of the hour, about 5:30, I will review the latest income and poverty numbers that came out earlier this week from the Census Bureau. But just a couple of words on the news headlines, economic news headlines. This morning, the Labor Department reporting that initial claims for jobless insurance, that weekly indicator of the number of people who just lost their jobs and go over to sign up for unemployment insurance benefits, very sensitive and timely indicator of the state of the job market, that was down by 2,000 last week after rising 4,000 the previous week. It's been flattish in the low 300,000 area for several weeks now, and as I've been saying all along, it's comports with a good but not great job market. Tomorrow morning at 8:30, we'll hear from the Bureau of Labor Statistics on the state of the job market in August. The number of new jobs created, expect to see not so many of them, around 100,000, which is pretty subpar, possible increase in the unemployment rate. And it does look like we've seen the best of this business cycle for now. It's not heading into recession yet, but this does seem to be a maturing cycle. The ABC News Washington Post weekly measure of consumer attitudes falling last week by a strong 5 points. Now it is down to the levels it was in the middle of May. It took a steep dive in April and May, recovered through early July, and now has fallen again. And it does seem that the rather weak job market and high gasoline prices and the fact that most ordinary Americans are not doing so well in this economy has really been weighing on consumer attitudes, which doesn't necessarily mean that people are not spending. This morning reported that chain store sales up almost 3% in the month of August over the previous August, and that come down from July, but still people are spending money. Even though they profess to be downbeat and broke, they continue to spend money. And one reason for that is that they seem to be back in the habit of borrowing money against the value of their houses. While mortgage applications for new home purchases have been falling, those for refinancings, which generally involves taking a large chunk of cash out when one refinances, that has been popping back up for the last several weeks. I mentioned here a few weeks ago that the British housing market is kind of a precedent for our own. When the Bank of England raised interest rates in 2003-2004, the housing market fell apart. But then when they stopped raising interest rates, the housing market came back again. So it takes a lot to deflate a housing bubble, apparently. And let's take this little musical break, and we'll be back to speak with Betsy Reed. And we're backed out a bit from the Gnarls Barkley song, Storm Coming. And Gnarls Barkley is a collaboration between the Baltimore-based DJ and producer Danger Mouse and the rapper-singer from Atlanta, CeeLo, who has apparently relocated to Baltimore to work with DJ Danger Mouse. And now we're joined in the studio by Betsy Reed, who is an editor of The Nation magazine and editor of the Nation Books volume, just published, called Unnatural Disaster, The Nation on Hurricane Katrina. Welcome to WBAI and Behind the News, Betsy.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So, give us an overview. What's in here? What kind of stuff has The Nation been writing about Katrina that's collected in this volume?
Well, it spans about probably about 8 months after the hurricane, and it includes a range of pieces, both reported pieces. There are two pieces by Christian Parenti, who visited New Orleans in the Gulf right in the wake of the storm, and our columnists are almost all represented: Pat Williams, Alex Coburn, and it's divided. The first section of the book is really kind of surveying the damage and covering the immediate political reaction, but it also includes a substantial section on a people's reconstruction, which is mostly focused on what reconstruction could have looked like had the left had a shred of political power.
Well, let's come back to that a little bit later, because we always like to talk about how things could have been done. But we're being treated to this right now. But how badly were things done? How badly did things go that Nation reported?
Well, I think we all know that they went pretty badly. the title being Unnatural Disaster. It was, I think, one of the virtues of what is in here is that it includes not just coverage of what's now fairly well known about the political decisions that led to a failure to invest in the levees, the investment instead in the war in Iraq, and the well known sort of humiliation of President Bush and FEMA and Michael Brown, who really is the guy who took the fall, the one guy who took the fall, and actually has landed on his feet, amazingly enough.
And now he's a disaster recovery consultant. Yeah. I guess speaking from personal experience.
He actually has clients.
Yes.
Which tells you something. I mean,
there are second acts in American life, Fitzgerald, to the contrary. But actually, there's an introduction by Adolph Reed to this volume, and I had Adolph on here a month or two ago to talk about the contents. But he makes a point that everyone focuses on race, and certainly you have to if you're talking about New Orleans and Hurricane Katrina. But he also talks about neoliberalism. What's his argument about that?
Well, I mean, he has a very pointed critique in particular of, you know, Ray Nagin and the black political establishment in New Orleans. And, you know, he unearths various facts which are really pretty shocking. Like, for example, that Nagin had distributed in poor neighborhoods before the storm a DVD telling people that there was no evacuation plan. So they were basically on their own before the hurricane. And then afterwards, instead of seeing this as a moment when the government, the local government, you know, maybe perhaps with the support of state and federal government, could invest in the city, in the public infrastructure, instead he fired 3,500 municipal employees and made a series of decisions that he framed in the language of race, but that in the end ended up solidifying the power of, you know, the landowning class. So basically putting the interests of homeowners over the interests of renters, and the renters, of course, in the end are, you know, disproportionately poor and black. So it had a definite, you know, racially discriminatory impact, but really, the whole thing was permeated by class politics.
Yeah, well, it looks like what looks like a lack of planning actually does have some kind of sinister logic behind it, which is to get the poor people out of town and rebuild it as a comfortable theme park.
Exactly. And also that has a long history given, you know, the HUD programs, not just under Bush, but under Clinton. I think the HOPE 6 program, which was, you know, a glorified means of getting rid of public housing in this country.
That's the voice of Betsy Reed, who is editor of The Nation magazine and editor of the volume, Unnatural Disaster, a collection of pieces from The Nation on Hurricane Katrina and its aftermath, just published by Nation Books. We are now joined by Gary Young. Welcome to the studio, Gary.
Hi.
You are a British journalist who's been in this country for a while, but were you shocked by what happened in New Orleans?
I was shocked, actually. I mean, I think what's more interesting is how America was shocked. In a way, I mean, I was shocked that, given everything that had happened, that they just, in terms of competence, they simply couldn't get it together, and that wasn't an accident. But the way in which there was this privatized response to a clearly public problem was
the reputation of the U.S. to ourselves and also to a lot of the world once was that we were kind of a can-do country.
Right.
We may not be philosophers, we may not be reflective people, but we're can-do types, and that seems to have been destroyed.
Right, and you have the NBA president with his CEO presidency, and it came at a time when America was strutting its stuff on a global stage and saying, we're going to bring freedom and democracy to the world. And I was actually in Jamaica when Katrina hit, and just to listen to people in Jamaica talk about, well, you know, geez, so this is the kind of freedom and democracy they want to spread around the world. There was a kind of, in many ways, I think Katrina was more damaging to America's international reputation than Iraq has been, because it blew the lid on the kind of Disneyfied idea that most of the world has of what America is like, and showed what it truly is like for many people, that this is a superpower who can't clear up corpses on its own street for weeks. And to that extent, it was stunning. It felt like coming in, I came in about 4 days after the storm. I came straight from Jamaica to New Orleans. And it looked like Haiti with skyscrapers. All of the symbols of power and wealth and influence that were still standing, and yet you looked around you and what you saw was absolute devastation and lots of poor people, most of whom were black, kind of struggling to get the basic necessities, and we as journalists could get in there. And so it seemed incomprehensible as to why no help, you know, otherwise could arrive. And that was, in a way, in that first week, Katrina was a picture story. You just looked at the pictures and there it was. And people in Britain were calling me and saying, well, what is this about? It can't be what it looks like. But it was exactly what it looked like.
Well, yeah, what happened certainly was what it looked like, but why? I mean, I think a lot of people would like to just point at the Bush administration as being responsible for the failings, and certainly they have a lot to answer for, but is that the whole story, or is this some sort of symptom of an American crisis?
Well, I mean, all of the evils of the Bush administration were on display. The racism, the kind of reverse affirmative action that put someone like Michael Brown, you know, this is an administration that struts around in Supreme Court saying the best people should get the job. Here's this man who worked for the International Arabian Horse Association, running the country's, kind of steering the country out of its kind of time of crisis.
Well, Bush himself, a beneficiary of affirmative action at Yale and Harvard.
Exactly. And it highlighted all of these things about the Bush administration. But Bush did not create racism. He didn't create poverty. He is not the only character who has kind of advocated small government. And it's telling that none of these issues, in the 9 months earlier there was a presidential election and none of these issues came up. So it kind of, to leave it at Bush's door is far too convenient, I think, because there are kind of, it exposed far deeper flaws and fault lines in American society that aren't addressed, because Bush is a very kind of convenient kind of whipping boy for everybody. He absolutely has to take responsibility for what he didn't do as opposed to what he did. But if you don't go any further than that, then you lose the kind of principal essence. I mean, here was an opportunity to talk about race and class in an intelligent way that was no longer abstract. Here was an opportunity to talk about the legacy of segregation in a way that was no longer abstract. And to that extent, the political class completely blew it. I mean, completely. The Democrats have not come up with an alternative to how New Orleans should be rebuilt, how one should prepare for, a crisis of that kind, and how you deal with the issues that Katrina exposed. The people who couldn't get out were the people who couldn't get on. And the Democrats haven't come up with an answer to that in the last year either. So it's kind of just, it's too easy to lay it at Bush's, to leave it at Bush's door and not kind of move further into what America's political class is doing. And that was true all the way through the year, not just in the immediate, we kind of concentrate on the most compelling stuff, which is immediately afterwards, but in the year that followed, predominantly African-American communities were disenfranchised from voting for mayor. Adolf Reed is right in the way that he kind of describes the way that Nagin used race as symbol rather than substance, that kind of that was all he had, really, was the fact that he was black, and he played it for all that he could, which
he came from and represented the corporate class of New Orleans.
They called him Ray Reagan, and there was a good reason for that. One of the principal reasons why he didn't clear people out earlier was because he was worried that the city would be sued. He was looking out for the business interests of the hotels and so on. But he didn't run with any, and this is a kind of problem within African American leadership, that kind of sometimes race is all they've got. It's not just all they talk about, it's all they've got. And they don't ally the issue of race to the kind of other issues that kind of, you know, that affect and infect it, like class, like gender. I mean, 82%, I think in June, 82% of the displaced people in Houston were black women. Of course, because black women are the ones most likely to have childcare responsibilities, most likely to be looking after the elderly, and therefore the least able to move around the country and look for work and so on. So this kind of, it didn't even affect the whole black community in the same way. And yet a lot of these issues got buried under race, but without any kind of significant leadership to kind of give it expression, not just black leadership, any leadership.
That's the voice of Gary Young, who is a reporter for columnist now? Yeah. A correspondent for The Guardian newspaper in Britain and a frequent writer for The Nation and a contributor of a couple of pieces in this new volume on natural disaster of The Nation on Hurricane Katrina, just out from Nation Books. Well, for a moment a year ago, it looked like we were actually being confronted with some break in the normal discourse. We were going to have a discussion of race and class. I was seeing amazing things on TV that I never expected ever to see on American television. That disappeared within a couple of weeks. What happened?
Well, I think that, I mean, it was amazing for those couple of weeks. It was like teenagers who just discovered sex. It was suddenly these things that you thought, well, these were always here, but suddenly it was on the front page of Time, you know, race and poverty. Without any political leadership to give those things expression, it just curdled into a rage. And the rage is, in a way, the rage dissipated somewhat. The anger at Bush is still there. His approval ratings still haven't recovered, but there was nowhere for it to go. Where was this fury going to go? Where was the leadership? Where were the unions? Where was the Democratic Party? Where was black leadership? I mean, there were people who went down there. Jesse Jackson went down there, but with no coherent base with which to kind of rally anything significant. So while it definitely did highlight all of the flaws in the Bush administration, it also kind of shone a light on the weaknesses in the left to actually cohere that anger into something more than just fury, but to some kind of alternative agenda, and to give those discussions of race and class some kind of meat and direction.
Yeah, when I interviewed you a few months ago about your collection of essays, the New Press published, whose title now escapes me,
Stranger in a Strange Land.
Stranger in a Strange Land, yes. You pointed out very astutely, I thought, that there's a broad kind of, you know, left of center kind of thought among the population, a whole array of sentiments that don't have any kind of public political expression.
Mm.
Why do you think that is?
I suppose if I had the full answer to that, I could start either my own party or my own radio show or something. I kind of, there's opposition to Bush, but there's no resistance. And the resistance, or little resistance, and that resistance needs some vehicle. And the Democratic Party has proved itself incapable of being that vehicle. No new vehicle has come up. We haven't created a new vehicle.
You could argue that the whole function of the Democratic Party is to prevent that from emerging.
Well, that certainly is what it feels like. I mean, I wish I knew. I mean, part of it must come from the kind of the decimation of the left over the past kind of 20, 30, 40 years, and really since the kind of McCarthy era, that kind of hasn't been able to kind of get back on its feet to even talk of a left. You know, you talk of liberals and progressives, but to talk of a left is really to try and invent some kind of coherence that that doesn't exist. But in moments like this, you see the need for the left, and you also see the potential for the left. What you don't see is the left.
Betsy, you look like you wanted to say something.
Well, just coming off what you were saying, I mean, I do think that there is potential in the sentiment, and you actually, you know, you saw that in the wake of the hurricane, that there was this outpouring of, you know, sympathy for the victims. There was this, you know, interest suddenly in race and class. But, well, first of all, you also saw the hypocrisy of so much public discourse. I mean, Bush himself went down there and acknowledged that there were, you know, the roots of this crisis were in, you know, decades of racial discrimination. But then, you know, the Republicans turned around and submitted, you know, an incredibly draconian.
Well, racial
budget.
Discrimination has been their meal ticket for the last 30
right.
years.
Right? So people say the right. I mean, in some ways, there have been some victories in terms of rhetoric and discourse. So people will say the right things on race and even class issues. But then, you know, the question of who actually wields the power. I mean, we saw the left, you know, has no infrastructure or institutional power. The right controls everything. And they, you know, even if they actually say that the things that people want to hear that sound right to our ears, there's nothing there to stop them from turning around and undermining those very, you know, principles.
You mentioned earlier, this is a good thing, I think, to close on, you mentioned earlier that there was a possibility of some kind of people's reconstruction that has been completely brushed aside. But what was that all about?
Well, I mean, there's still a grassroots movement, and Gary can speak to that, having actually gone down there and talked to some of these groups. I mean, ACORN is very active on the ground. There was a lot of resistance to the proposals that were unveiled to sort of build a smaller and whiter city that actually, you know, stalled some of those proposals. So, and there were also big ideas that the left advanced, at least, you know, in print and here and there. I mean, you're right that there's no vehicle to advance the left's ideas. But you did see in this moment, I mean, you know, what more stark a display of the need for a government could we possibly have had? You know, I mean, the years of denigration of the very idea that, you know, a public sector is worth having. By, you know, both parties, really. I mean, with the participation of the Democrats, I mean, that was challenged by this moment, and there were a few voices, at least, out there were talking about government in a different way, you know?
Gary Young, what did you say?
Well, presented a, you know, singularly gloomy prognosis, but what I would say is the kind of one area that has been invigorating has been the grassroots movements. I mean, it would be worse were it not for them. They were the ones who managed to mobilize large numbers of people to vote, even when they were kind of effectively disenfranchised by not having voting stations outside of the state. The trouble was they had no one to vote for. There's the kind of problem with the vehicle. But it would have been a lot worse. I mean, what they wanted to get away with, the smaller, whiter, wealthier city, was frustrated, and one of the reasons that there's chaos in the rebuilding program now is because the plan that they wanted to do was scuppered by grassroots resistance. What those grassroots people couldn't do was kind of put forward an alternative plan themselves. That, for that, they needed more assistance at higher levels, and that assistance wasn't coming. There was a woman, Linda Jeffers, at one of the mayoral candidate hustings, who said politics is a battle between organized people and organized money. And organized money was out there within a couple of weeks, putting up forward its plan.
Was that local New Orleans money?
From the Heritage Foundation, put forward about 20 free market proposals for what to do in New Orleans within 2 weeks of the... I mean, they hadn't yet cleared up the dead from the streets, let alone the dead in the houses. But organized people would take a lot longer because they were scattered and because they were poor. But they kind of... they managed to stop things getting much, much worse, even if they didn't manage to make things much, much better.
It looks like the right wants to turn this into a laboratory for a right-wing social policy, doesn't it?
Those 25 ideas are actually included in the book in a piece that ran as a sidebar to Naomi Klein's article. It's a list of pro-free market ideas for responding to Hurricane Katrina and high gas prices. Circulated by the House Republican Study Committee, and it is really stunning. I mean, from automatically suspending the Davis-Bacon prevailing wage laws, which there is one small victory, is that they were the administration after the outcry. I mean, they actually did that, but then they had to reverse themselves. So.
But they're always ready, but so is the same set of prescriptions, no matter what the situation. They've got them right in their back pocket. Thanks to both of you. I've been speaking with Betsy Reed, whose voice you just heard. She's an editor of The Nation magazine and editor of the collection on natural disaster, The Nation on Hurricane Katrina, just out from Nation Books. And Gary Young, who's been also here, a correspondent for The Guardian newspaper and a contributor of several articles to this collection. Thanks to both of you. Good luck with the book. And let's take a break, and we'll be back with John Mueller eventually.
This is Lawrence Block, and you're listening to WBAI in New York City. Listener-supported and non-commercial.
This is WBAI on New York, 99.5 FM on the radio dial, and WBAI.org on the web. And my name is Doug Henwood. The show is Behind the News. And before we get John Mueller, just a couple of words about the Census Bureau's annual income and poverty numbers, which came out earlier this week. I'll be taking a closer look at all this next week when we talk with Sylvia Allegretto of the Economic Policy Institute about the latest edition of their biannual State of Working America. And I also should have Mark Levitan of the Community Service Society to talk about income and poverty in New York City. That's next week. But in the meanwhile, just a quick observation, some quick observations about the Census Bureau's annual income and poverty numbers, which are released late August, early September every year for the previous year. In a phrase, not so good. Real median income, that is the income of a household at the very middle of the income distribution, adjusted for inflation, was up just 1% last year, a decent but not spectacular number by any means. But that was driven entirely by higher incomes among older households, that is those headed by someone 65 or older. Yes, I know head of household is a problematic concept, but that's what the statisticians use. For non-elderly households, though, incomes were down by 0.5%. That's a remarkably bad performance for the fourth year of an economic expansion. Usually incomes decline in recessions and then rise soon after. That pattern was first broken in the jobless recovery of the early 1990s and has been repeated with more severity in this decade. The link between economic growth and actual people's living standards seems to have been broken. Since 2000, the broad economy has grown by almost 2001 rather, the broad economy has grown by almost 5%, adjusting for population growth, while the average household's income is down about 3%. That's a very large gap, 8 percentage points, between economic growth and income growth. Also, the poverty rate declined slightly to 12.6%, but that's still above the level in the recession year of 2001. This is the first time since the stats began in the early 1960s that the poverty rate has failed to decline 4 years after recession was over. And those who are poor are getting poorer. The average poor person was $3,200 below the poverty line, the highest poverty gap as it's sometimes called, on record. 43% of the officially poor had incomes less than half the poverty line. By the way, the poverty line for a family of three is just over $15,000. For a family of four, just under $20,000. And that's not adjusted for the high expense of living in a place like New York either. These are extremely extremely tight-fisted ideas of poverty. If we had a more generous and humane definition of poverty, the rates would be 20 to 25% in this phenomenally rich country. Still more bad news. Median earnings of both male and female full-time workers fell last year. Almost 2% for men and 1.3% for women. So the dismal income performance of a gain of a half percent for the average household was achieved only by sending more members to work and making them work longer hours and harder. And yet even more bad news, the number of people without health insurance rose by over a million to almost 47 million, almost 16% of the population. The number of uninsured children rose for the first time since 1998. What a miraculous economy. Let's take a little musical break and come back with John Mueller. The Kinks, a little bit of their old song, Acute Paranoia Schizophrenia Blues. And shortly after September 11th, my friend Michael Pollack posted something to the listserv I run saying that he thought that we wouldn't see another 9/11 type attack in our lifetimes. That it was just as likely to be hit twice by lightning that there would be another terrorist attack of that magnitude. I was skeptical at the time, but he may have been right and may have been prescient. John Mueller, who is a professor of political science at Ohio State and author of the book Remnants of War, has a piece in the September-October issue of Foreign Affairs magazine asking, is there still a terrorist threat? And answering, probably not. Welcome to WBAI, John Mueller.
Hi, nice to be here.
So, the Bush administration wants us to believe that the terrorists are all among us, just about ready to strike, and they're especially eager to push this line with the elections coming up in November. You are very skeptical. Why is that?
Well, it just seems to me that the threat, I do think there's something of a threat, but that it's been massively exaggerated. And what I'm trying to do in this article is bring out the possibility that fits the evidence perfectly that they don't exist or they scarcely exist. The other arguments, for example, that we've got incredibly great protection here doesn't fit very well. Obviously, even better protection in Israel when they've had terrorist attacks. The borders are obviously, they may have caught some bad guys coming over the border, but nonetheless, you have huge amounts of people coming in legally and illegally, not to mention all kinds of bad substances that they're trying to stop, like drugs. So the idea that we've got perfectly, perfect border security is very dubious as well. And the other arguments seem to be also less than convincing. And one possibility, I can't be sure about it, obviously, but a distinct possibility is they simply don't exist or don't exist in very big numbers. Terrorists, to cause a lot of damage, don't have to have large numbers, as we saw in Washington with the sniper attack. It took two guys with a gun and a car to terrorize the capital of the home of the brave for a couple of weeks there. And so consequently, we're not talking about having thousands of people coming across the border and doing something, but even just a tiny number. And the evidence suggests maybe they aren't here. The FBI actually had a report, which as far as I know is still secret, published last year, produced last year, which suggested that, concluded that they'd been unable to find any true terrorist cell in the United States after a huge amount of well-funded sleuthing. And as far as I can see, that may well still be true. Anyway, I want to raise it. In some respects, what's odd about it is people are not saying this. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe, you know, we'll have to see what happens. But it seems to be a perfectly plausible explanation for what's going on. And it should be certainly part of the public discussion.
It's just before we went on the air with Betsy Reed from The Nation magazine earlier, she said they've got a piece coming out in their September 11th anniversary issue by Mustafa Bayoumi, who has been on this show a couple of times, who lives in Brooklyn and has been researching the Arab-American community there, who says that the FBI is all over Arab neighborhoods in Brooklyn. They're in mosques. They're in organizations. They're paying people who, you know, grew up in the neighborhoods to be informers. And evidently they're finding nothing. Does that seem plausible to you?
Yeah, it seems to be the case, yeah. I don't know if, I mean, the Muslim community is sort of the lamppost under which the FBI is looking for the terrorists and looking for their lost keys. Basically, you don't need the Muslim community. The 9/11 hijackers stayed away from the Muslim community almost entirely. And the similar situation with the situation in Madrid, for example. So consequently, if you're a terrorist, what you want to do is stay far away from the Muslim community. But anyway, they've been looking there, they've been looking everywhere. Two thirds of the people in the FBI who used to be working on crime have been diverted to working on terrorism, which has not only have they not found much of anything, but they've also, there's some indication that the recent rise of the crime rate is because police and the FBI have been so focused on terrorism.
Well, the Bush administration has to manage a neat political trick. On the one hand, they have to keep the threat alive. On the other hand, they have to reassure us that they're keeping us safe. How can both things be true at the same time?
Well, they keep saying, you know, we're working very hard, but the threat is still there, and we have to keep doing it. The Democrats are saying pretty much the same thing overall. I don't know if it would be that much different if a Democrat in office. Maybe it would be, but it seems to me that from Bush's standpoint, terrorism has obviously been his very strongest suit, and it'd be politically unnatural for him not to notice. So they're likely to keep working on this.
Well, I'm going to ask you to read their minds, which is something, of course, you can't do. But do they know this, and they're just using this as a cynical political maneuver, or do they really believe their own propaganda, do you think?
I think they believe it. I think it's really quite genuine. Also, when something's been really good for you politically, and you tend to think it's there. And huge numbers of people in the United States are very much concerned. It's also politicians tend to play to. I think they less create fears than they stoke them. So in this case, basically, what's happened is they know this plays well. Fears of terrorism are still there. The polls sort of indicate that since 9/11, the number of people worried about terrorist attack in the United States hasn't diminished, despite the fact there hasn't been any. And if you ask the question, do you think there'll be a terrorist attack within the next 3 months or something like that, the percentage of people saying that's not at all likely hasn't grown, despite the fact that that group has been consistently right ever since 9/11. So it's still out there. And what bothers me is there's almost no real discussion about terrorism in terms of its context. A friend of mine, an astronomer, has calculated that a resident of the globe, at present rates, the chance of being killed by an international terrorist over a course of a lifetime of 80 years is about 1 in 80,000, which is about the same chance of being killed by a asteroid or meteor or comet. The number of Americans outside of 9/11 who have been killed by terrorists in the United States is incredibly small, smaller than the number, in fact, who have died drowning in toilets. And furthermore, if you just look at the situation since 9/11 and you look at all the people in the world who have been outside of Iraq in warlike situations like in Iraq and Afghanistan, all the people in the world who have been killed by al-Qaeda or al-Qaeda types or maybe al-Qaeda types if over these 5 years, it comes to be maybe 800 or 900 people in the whole world, not Americans, but anybody. And the United States loses each year about 300 people drowning in bathtubs. In other words, more people have drowned in bathtubs in the United States than since 9/11 than have been killed by al-Qaeda types since 9/11. Now, maybe they've got a knockout punch they're just working for, and they've got all these nuclear weapons they're polishing up in Pakistan or someplace, and they're going to loose them someplace. But so far, at least, it doesn't look like it's that formidable an organization. It is a threat. They are up to no good. They are contemptible and so forth, obviously. But so my concern is not about their quality, but rather their quantity and their capacity to do much damage. And one possibility is they really have their capacity to do damage has been much exaggerated.
Speaking with John Mueller, professor of political science at Ohio State University and author of a piece in Foreign Affairs magazine called Is There Still a Terrorist Threat? Right. That's in the September-October issue.
Yeah, can I add, by the way, my publisher will kill me if I don't mention that this is all coming out at a book called Overblown, republished by Free Press in November.
Oh, well, by all means, please say that. As an author myself, I've never to plug a book.
Yeah, so if they're listening, I did my duty.
All right, well, I'll do it again at the end. Well, on the face of it, it looks like it would be like five people should be able to blow up the Lincoln Tunnel. I mean, you know,
sure.
A truck full of explosives and detonate it. That doesn't seem like it should be very hard. So is there something we're missing? I mean, is it the fact that they're just it's harder than it looks? Or that there are fewer people who are motivated to do things like that than a lot of people would believe? What's going on?
Yeah, well, terrorism is pretty rare. The number of people actually doing it, you know, is not very significant, as the numbers indicated. But clearly it's easy to do, you know, like the snipers in Washington. Getting bomb materials together. I mean, five guys with five matches could set off five forest fires, you know. And then since that wouldn't be suicidal, if they had two matches, they could set off 10, you know. To create a traffic jam by just shooting from an overpass. There are all kinds of things that can happen, starting fires, minor explosions that can spread. Very complicated things like chemical weapons or biological weapons or nuclear weapons are, you know, may be beyond their capacity substantially. But the amount of mayhem, as certainly as you see in Israel, that they can wreak can be very high. So it seems to me that maybe they simply aren't here, or certainly aren't here in more than trace numbers. When they have picked up people in the United States and they made big play about them, they have tended to be pretty flaky. You know, the guy who was going to take down the Brooklyn Bridge with a blowtorch, or those guys in Florida who are going to go to Chicago and kick down the Sears Tower with their new boots, or the guys in Canada who are going to, you know, behead the Prime Minister. We may be down to sort of the flaky fringe now. These guys may be dangerous, and they might really do something bad, but it's unlikely to do something monumentally bad.
Well, in a lot of cases, it's the cop on the scene who's acting as ringleader for some of these people who are just nuts sitting around bragging, and then the cop comes up with some entrapment.
Yeah, that's right. That's a danger, particularly in the case in Florida, that they're sort of egged on by this informer or whatever, double agent. What you get is, as one lawyer, I think, put it, jihadist bravado. You know, boy, I could do all this kind of, you know, sort of swaggering around, and it's rather unpleasant swaggering around if you're talking about blowing up a building, obviously. But that doesn't mean it's a serious threat.
What if the terrorist threat isn't so much the number of deaths, but the mob psychology, the fear that they create to get into this building? I have to show a picture ID.
Yeah.
I mean, this is an office building in Manhattan. You know, Wall Street, where this building is located, is like an armed camp. The New York Stock Exchange is surrounded by guys with machine guns, for God's sake. Is that really what the terrorists are aiming to accomplish, rather than killing large numbers of people?
Yes. Well, I don't know if they also want to do the other, I suppose. But the biggest effect of terrorism, certainly economically and indeed sometimes in terms of human lives, comes from the reaction to it. One spectacular, horrible example of that is a study coming out of the University of Michigan about traffic deaths in 2001. And what they found was that about 1,000 people died, Americans died, between September 11th and the end of that year because they drove rather than flew. And if a tiny percentage of the, you know, 150,000 deaths that we've suffered so far on the highways since that time are due to the same fact, we may have lost more people because of that evasive behavior than we lost on 9/11. So what you get is these huge, expensive opportunity costs. I mean, no one, when Bloomberg, you know, sends these cops to guard the subway, no one seems to say, how much is this costing us, for God's sake? It's very expensive, and as well as inconvenient and time-consuming and frustrating. I've seen one estimate for the Los Angeles airport to simply go from yellow alert to orange alert, which is where they are now, I still assume, costs $100,000 a day in additional security costs. That's just one airport. So you got these things multiplied all over the place. You've also got people running around trying to figure out what could be targets. And so the Congress in 2001 or two demanded that the Office and now the Department of Homeland Security come up with a list of potential terrorist targets. Well, by 2003, they'd come up with 30,000 terrorist targets. And Tom Ridge even was a little bit disconcerted by this huge number. But a year later, it had gone up to 80,000. Including on his list are miniature golf courses and Weekiwachee Springs, which is a water park in Florida that has mermaids in it. It just gets basically bizarre. And so now you have security cameras, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of security cameras going in a little town in Alaska that has 2,800 people in it. It comes out about one security camera for every 40 people. If it weren't so expensive and so forth and sometimes so costly in terms of human life, it would be sort of exercises in self-parody. But it just keeps going and going. And then, of course, you get the politicians and others and local officials who say, hey, they're throwing money at stuff. Maybe they'll throw it at me. And so you get all kinds of bizarre expenditures. There's they're coming out of Homeland Security of people, trying to pump the money from the federal coffers in the usual sort of pork barrel manner.
And in the foreign affairs piece, you cite one view that 9/11 was a sign of Al Qaeda's desperation, isolation, fragmentation, and decline, not of its strength. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, that's particularly quoting a really good book by a guy named Gerges, who's at Sarah Lawrence, called The Far Enemy. And there's a fairly substantial number of people who are, you know, Middle East specialists and specializing in Arab extremism and Muslim extremism, who see that basically the Al-Qaeda was a very, very fringe group, and that even other violent jihadists, much less nonviolent jihadists, but even violent jihadists thought that striking what they call the far enemy, namely Europe and particularly the United States, was monstrous and really very stupid. And in summary, their argument is that, I'm basically quoting him in that case, that this was a desperation move. Now, what's happened since 9/11 is a real clampdown. I'm very much in favor of a certain amount of policing, but most of the policing that's been effective has not been here, but has been overseas. So one possibility for explaining why there haven't been any attacks is that the FBI is extremely incompetent. They can't find these people. Well, much less effective policing agencies around the world have found a lot of these guys and have sort of lowered the boom on them. In addition, Al-Qaeda since that time has come up with some really stupid maneuvers in terms of terrorism. For example, stupid from its own standpoint. For example, it's a little bit hard to imagine a more stupid target than a hotel wedding. But that's what they managed to blow up in Amman, Jordan. There's maybe a baby nursery in a hospital would be a more stupid target. But, you think about the wedding. From a public relations standpoint, everybody's happy and dressed up, and they've been planning for years, and then this guy goes in and blows up 20 or 50 of them. And the reaction in Jordan to that was just total outrage against these idiots. Before that, polls showed about 25% of the people had a favorable opinion of Osama bin Laden. After it, there was less than 1%. So that's been happening since 9/11 is, basically from their standpoint, really stupid terrorist activities have been counterproductive. The same thing happens in Saudi Arabia. After some attacks there, the Saudis got really serious about it, not because they love the United States, not because they love the United States policy in Iraq, but from their own selfish interests that this is a dangerous stuff to them as well. The Syrians and even the Iranians have been quite cooperative in trying to get rid of these guys. They don't like them either.
And I was speaking with John Mueller, who is a professor of political science at Ohio State and author of the forthcoming book, Overblown, coming out from the Free Press. Let's just, in a couple of minutes remaining, I want to turn to another area of your expertise, public opinion about war. And you had a piece also in Foreign Affairs about a year ago called The Iraq Syndrome. What can you tell us about the course of public opinion about the war in Iraq? Is it unusual compared to previous wars?
It's followed pretty much the same pattern in the sense that it's possible to do really precise comparisons because the same question was asked in Korea and Vietnam. And essentially the same pattern holds. All three wars start out with a fair amount of rally around the flag support, and it eroded as casualties came in. It eroded faster at the beginning than the end because as you lose the sort of weak supporters, you're down to the harder core, so therefore the decline tends to slow, but it continues. The big difference, however, is that the casualty levels, when I was writing that article, it was something like 2,000 Americans had died at that point in the war in Iraq, and support levels for the war in Iraq were down to the point where they were in Vietnam when 20,000 had died. So the implication from this pretty clearly is that people value the war in Iraq much. They're willing to spend far fewer lives in the war in Iraq than they were in either in Vietnam or Korea. That seems to be the main difference. But the basic pattern of sort of erosion of support over time, sometimes bumping up a little bit if there's some good news, but that doesn't last very long. Sometimes bumping down if there's bad news like Abu Ghraib, but then sort of coming back to where it was, seems to be a pretty consistent pattern across all three wars. And it doesn't seem very likely that Bush, through rhetoric, he's starting a new propaganda blast, I think tomorrow, maybe started today, is likely to be able to turn it around. It's not a matter of rhetoric. It's a matter of facts on the ground, and the facts on the ground, of course, have been pretty terrible coming from Iraq, and he hasn't had much good news to put forward for months or maybe a year.
Yeah, and you recall that Johnson also tried these propaganda blasts and with very little success.
Yeah, that's right. What matters, and people are not idiots, it's not what the president says, it's what's happening. And they may, you know, like to hear some good news and some good words and so forth, but it's not a matter of rhetoric. It's a matter of what's actually happening. War is not exactly what you call a subtle phenomenon. People know what they look like, know what they feel like, and don't like the fact that these people are dying in it. And if it doesn't seem to be, you know, if it seems to be likely to go on forever and continue to become very costly, they're going to gradually turn off. Basically what happens is people reach... you might say individual tipping points. You know, eventually it becomes too rich for my blood, so I drop off, and another guy does who's a little bit more, you know. So what you get is this erosion of people basically dropping off the bandwagon. And once it's become too costly for you, you're not likely to get back on, even if the war starts to go fairly well. I mean, if it's been too costly now, you know, it's basically like buying a car. You know, if you pay too much for the car and you pay twice as much as it's worth, you still think it was a bad deal, even if you come to like the car. So it's been a sort of a rough, I think, cost-benefit analysis for most people, and that seems to be a pattern that's followed in all three of these wars.
Well, some people have argued that, as you point out in this article, that the American public is casualty-phobic. They don't care. Oh, no, not that it's casualty-phobic, rather, but it's defeat-phobic.
Yeah.
They don't care so much about the casualties, but if it looks like we're losing, then they turn on the war. What do you make of that argument?
Yeah, I've been in distinct disagreement with that. There's particularly Peter Fever, who's working in the National Security Council now, holds that view, and you know, he's a friend of mine. We've argued about it extensively. And it just seems to be that what my idea is that you have this erosion of support, and then good news tends to bump it up a bit or bump it down, bad news bump it down a bit, but then it goes back to where it was. So he's right in the sense that sometimes good news, you know, increases support. But my counterargument is it doesn't last very long. It goes back down to where it was. And I can show that in Korea and Vietnam as well as in the current war. So, and ultimately, the big picture is that the Americans aren't defeat phobic. I mean, the biggest catastrophe in American foreign policy history was Vietnam, and went down the tubes in 1975, 1976 election. It doesn't even come up. There was a fiasco in Somalia in 1993. Clinton withdrew the troops, and you know, people forgot about it. In 1983, there was a fiasco, the horrible explosion that killed 283 Americans in Lebanon by a suicidal terrorist. Reagan huffed and puffed for a while, then gradually pulled the troops out. Next year was 1984. His reelection campaign hardly came up. So it seems to me Americans are not defeat phobic. They don't like to be defeated. Who does? But they get over it pretty quickly and get back to, you know, they resume their lives.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us. I've been speaking with John Mueller, who is a professor of political science at Ohio State University and author of the forthcoming book, Overblown, about the terrorist threat, coming out from the Free Press in October. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the evening. I will be back next week. And let's go out with a song I played before and which I cannot get out of my head, by Nerina Palo. Where is the title? Well, it's Nerina Palo. Everybody's gone to war. That's what it is. Till next week. Bye.